From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You know, they say crime doesn't pay.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
But it can be very interesting. This whole hour we'll talk about crime, how to handle it among young people, how to solve it when the trail goes cold, and how to write about it when it's imaginary.
In the book, Julia, the oldest sister, when she's 19 years old, she's a college student at UGA, and she just disappears. They have no idea what happened to her. And I wanted to explore what would happen to a family broken apart by a crime like that.
Of course, we'd love to have you join this conversation. Do you watch crime shows? And would you rather watch a documentary about something true or a fictional show in which the good guys usually win? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Recent data from the U.S. Department of Education shows high school graduation rates in the state rose by 6% in the past year. For the last few years, the city of Savannah has been trying to reach out to at-risk youth who may end up in the school-to-prison pipeline. Every summer, for 7 weeks, Savannah-Chatham County youth can be part of a pre-apprentice program. I wanted to learn more about it, and so I spoke last year with Patricia Merritt, who at the time was the district manager for the Georgia Department of Juvenile Justice. She handpicked the youths selected in this program. Ed Risler also joined us. He's the former chair of the Board of Juvenile Justice and a retired University of Georgia professor. Patricia told me this program is a game changer for at-risk youth.
This opportunity is a groundbreaking opportunity for the Department of Juvenile Justice and youth who are involved with the Chatham County Juvenile Court. These youth have the opportunity to learn new skills while they're earning money. And so that's very exciting for the kids and also exciting for us with the Department of Juvenile Justice and in our community.
So you ended up having two different conversations, one with parents and one with kids. I wondered if you'd tell us about the conversations we had with kids first, because we are talking about spending your summer working, and it's not just working these jobs. They have a lot of other responsibilities that go with this program. So how did you sell it, and was it a hard sell?
Well, one of the things, Celeste, that some may be surprised about, kids really want to work. And when we work with our teens with the Department of Juvenile Justice, they often come to us asking us to work with them to help build skills and to get them connected to job training programs. And so this is one program that we at Department of Juvenile Justice in Savannah, we've been wanting over the last couple of years to become a partner with it. And so when that opportunity became available through our connection with Lieutenant Ramona Fambo with the Savannah Impact Program, we immediately went out and started meeting with our kids who were in the community, talking to them, wanting them to know clearly what the responsibilities would be, that they would be involved in working on job sites, working in the community, giving back through community service, also be exposed to academic enrichment opportunities. And so not all of them wanted to do it. And we only had 5 slots. And so looking at that, we really vetted these kids. We wanted to be very strict because this is the first year that DJJ has been invited to participate in this program. And so we knew that the kids that we picked had to be serious about it and serious about complying with every aspect of the program because, you know, next year we would want to be able to build on our experience this year. So we talked to them, and there were a few kids that said they were interested. And then the next step, we met with the parents. And I knew that parental support would be very important going into this program because I looked at the requirements and included mandatory parent meetings, and I knew that parents would need to be in a position that they would be able to support their children by going to those meetings, helping them with things like ID cards and uniforms,
right,
and just being there for the kids. And so in doing that, we did narrow it down, and there were parents. The parents of the kids who are in the program were the ones that said, I will do whatever I need to do to get my teen in this program. And so we were very excited.
Well, let me then turn to you, Ed. I want to play you this comment from Keith Jones, who's the director of reentry services for the Georgia Department of Juvenile Justice. And he's talking about how some programs are more effective than others at keeping kids out of jail, I guess.
Some programs will have a greater impact on the recidivism rate than others. So For instance, mentoring is one of those programs that is shown to have a pretty big effect. But the mentoring component is oftentimes tied to the faith-based component. The faith community is one of those resources that's just not tapped as well as we could probably tap it.
Now, Ed, this particular program obviously isn't really tapping the faith community. Instead, the mentors come in a daytime job. Does that work as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think what's important really to note with this is oftentimes we look at a program as being a panacea to sort of solve a youth's problem. And we have to realize that, you know, keeping a kid out of trouble is an ongoing process. And sometimes programs don't work for all kids. So the trick is matching the program with the kid.
Right.
You know, a program will work with some kids, but maybe not all kids. And I think maybe that's underscores a point that he made.
Now, when you were speaking with the producers, you were talking about sort of separating kids that get in trouble into percentages. Like, I think you said that 50% who get into trouble with the court system or law enforcement never return, right?
Well, that's typical in the research that I've done in the past. I mean, you know, generally, there's two kind of delinquents, those that get caught and those that don't. I think everybody that went through adolescence, which is a pretty turbulent period, we've all kind of skirted on the edges of maybe doing something. But yeah, most of them who go to court for the very first time don't come back. Then you have that other half that's left. You have about 6% of them, I think the research suggests, that commit about over half those crimes. So you have a small number that are really, really bad. But then you have that middle group of people that could teeter either way. And I think that's what makes this program in particular something that would maybe serve as a deterrent in an ongoing process that could build on.
So let me go back to you then, Patricia, because I wonder how you choose a kid. I mean, I heard you say they need parental support. They need to be willing to stand up to all of the requirements in this particular program. But is there a sort of a personality type? Are you looking for, as Ed was saying, those kids that are in that middle area?
Well, Celeste, we did use a very strict screening process for deciding who we would approach. And I guess when you look at personality, I did want to, there were kids that I was familiar with who had that easygoing personality. But beyond that, we looked at, you know, whether or not those kids were compliant with the terms of their supervision or probation. You know, were they attending school? You know, did we have any major issues being reported from school? And, you know, they just had to have that added support by their parents.
So why is this program, Patricia, and I'll ask the same thing of Ed, why is this program better than what we've seen in the past? I mean, there have been other reforms. There have been reforms in terms of keeping kids out of adult prisons, for example, or adult jails and putting them just in juvie. That's been shown not to necessarily work. Why do you think this program could work?
Well, Celeste, I think when you look at kids having the opportunity to learn about their community, learn employability skills, and learn on-the-job training, and get information about businesses in our community, and while they're doing that, they're earning money. To me, I think that's a success for not only the child, but that is also a success for our community.
And Ed, you know, obviously this program is now in its third year. As from a researcher's point of view, that's not enough data, I assume. But early results have shown that the program is very successful. And I wonder why that is. With all the other programs that are out there to help kids in trouble, why would giving them a job make a difference?
Well, first of all, bar none across the board, education and training is the best influence for any sort of future criminal activity. You know, you give them a skill, human capital, they can market that, that's for sure. I think what really makes this program special is it brings together the private sector, the businesses, where you have all these Coca-Cola, Holiday Inn, Hampton Inn, you know, Thunderbolt Marina. You have those people that are willing to invest as a community into the future of these youth. That's a tremendous thing. And I think new police chief Jack Lumpkin down there, who I know, who was chief of police up here in Athens, is a great guy. Adam Kennedy with the court. The people from DJJ should be applauded in this. But I think it's an ongoing process, and I like the idea that they're building on it. And I think, you know, as the data comes in, we'll hopefully we'll see some significant improvement in these youth.
Patricia, let me play you another comment from Delia Blake, the program coordinator in Savannah. And she's talking about how many kids over these 3 years they've had to kick out of the program.
For the past 3 years, I think we've only put out two, and that was for just behavior that was intolerable, whether it be trying to insinuate a fight or just being totally disrespectful to staff. So we put up with a lot of different behaviors just to try to correct them because that's what we're all about.
Patricia, what is success as far as you're concerned?
I think success is for our kids and all of the kids that are in this program, going through this program, learning about their community. I think that's important. When you look at kids learning how to comply with the norms of society, learning about the community is important, but also developing those employability skills, getting a mindset that's connected to school and employment, and then making some money for the summer. That's a success for those kids and a success for our community and also for Department of Juvenile Justice and the juvenile court.
And Ed, what do we as a society, as a nation, think of as success when it comes to dealing with kids in the juvenile justice system?
Wow, that's a pretty big question.
Yeah.
I think the idea is that we want them to understand that they do have a place in our society, given the skills that they can and take a role and build a life that makes them a contributing member that goes along with everybody else in our implied social contract that we sort of have with each other. And getting them to buy into that, they have to have some sort of commitment. And that's reciprocal. We have to show them that we're committed to them, so then they buy into the commitment of conventional values and participate accordingly. And hopefully, I think down the road, some of the outcomes which should show this. I would hope that in the fall, the kids do well in school, grades improve, maybe fewer disruptions with regard to that. But, you know, that's what we hope for, I think. But it takes an investment. The trouble is you don't see these things immediate. They're down the road. It's not like taking an aspirin and your headache goes away. I mean, this is something you might not see in fruition for several years down the road.
That's Ed Risler. He's the former chair of the Board of Juvenile Justice and a retired University of Georgia professor. We also heard from Patricia Merritt, who at the time was the district manager for the Georgia Department of Juvenile Justice. Coming up, a conversation with crime novelist Karen Slaughter. But first, would you volunteer your time to solve cold cases? Some people do.
Nobody knows that victim better than their mama or their sister or their cousin or their best friend. So we have to hear from them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are real familiar with the show, you know, First 48. Our concentration is the last 24.
This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we're talking about crime. And this is a good time to reintroduce a committed group of amateur detectives. Year after year, they volunteer to investigate unsolved criminal cases.
Rapper and actor Tupac Shakur died Friday night at the age of 25 in a Las Vegas hospital.
For almost 2 years, the bodies have kept coming out of Atlanta's rivers and woods. And week after week, police speak of sorrow and sympathy, but not a solution.
A scandal that erupted on Capitol Hill ignited a media firestorm. 24-year-old graduate student Chandra Levy had simply vanished.
Some cases, of course, are more well-known than others. Cheryl McCollum oversees the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. Cheryl joined me from Lincoln, Nebraska, where she was working on several cases. And I asked her to tell me what she's investigating over there.
Patricia Webb. She was found under a hay bale stack in the middle of a field of an abandoned farm in Nebraska some years ago. So I'll be walking that scene in about an hour after I leave here.
Okay. Also with us is LaShawn Bates, one of the Institute's longtime volunteers, also a bail bondsman and private investigator in Atlanta. LaShawn, nice to have you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Cheryl, let's start with you because walking across a field to recreate a murder is not, you know, most people's hobby. How did you get in? how did you actually start this institute? Because I understand it came out of you teaching a class.
It did. I was teaching a night class, and it was on criminal investigation, and I was running the cold case squad for a local sheriff's department, and I asked Sheriff Stewart if I could take one of my cases to the class because it was kind of difficult to engage students from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. after they had worked all day. And he said, sure, just, you know, take the names and addresses out and see what they can do with it. So that's what I did. And what happened in that classroom that night was nothing short of miraculous because they would not stop working. And I would look up and it would be 11:30 at night. And I would say, you know, y'all, I got to go. You know, I love you, but, you know, it's time for me to go home.
And this was in Atlanta.
It was. And so that way, I thought, you know, this is how I just have to continue to teach. So what I decided to do was I had other friends across the country that taught at different colleges, and everybody had a different discipline. And I thought, you know what, if we all looked at the same case at the same time, we might get onto something. And it kind of just moved from there and then kind of matriculated into the Institute, which now we're almost at 30 colleges across the country. Each college has a different area of discipline. We have over 2,000 students and approximately 600 experts that can all donate their time on one case to really give it a solid look.
And you have over 30 colleges, and how long do you spend? You all work on the same case, and how long does it generally take?
We devote a year, but it doesn't always take a year. For example, with Chandra Levy, it took us 4 months. And Bates and her group, they were done pretty quick with what they thought was a pretty good theory of what happened to turn that over to Metro. And so, you know, we work for nothing. We don't charge the families anything. We don't charge law enforcement anything. We are now a 501c3, so we can do some fundraising so that we can come to other states like California and, you know, Nebraska, New Mexico.
And as I understand it, you're a bit of an evangelist. And the reason I say that, LaShawn, is because you were just walking innocently down a hallway.
That's correct.
Cheryl passed you and dragged you into her cold case class.
Yes. Yes. I was going to a very boring class, God help me. And I just said, oh, I just really don't want to go to this class. And she said, hey, what's your name? And I said, LaShawn. She said, won't you come in here to my class? You want to be a part of the cold case team? I said, sure.
And describe for me what, because you were hooked after that very first class.
That very first
Why?
Class. She took me back.
What do you mean?
She took me back to exactly that day of the crime.
She walked you through the day of the crime.
Walked me through the day. She took my mind, my heart, my soul back that day.
And that did what for you? I mean, what made that want you to, because it was after taking this class and getting involved with the organization that you became a private investigator, correct?
Correct. It was an awakening. When you get an awakening of what your talents are and what your expertise in your own individual self are, that day, I knew exactly what I was meant to do because some of it came too natural.
Now, Cheryl, you sometimes bring in the victims' families to speak mm-hmm. with the volunteers. Why? What purpose does that serve?
Well, they've got to know who they're working for. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing. And it's important for the families to know there's somebody out there that still cares, that remembers what happened to their loved one and wants to do something about it. And the other thing that is so invaluable is the victimology of it. Mm. Nobody knows that victim better than their mama or their sister or their cousin or their best friend. So we have to hear from them. Mm. And a lot of people are real familiar with the show, you know, First 48.
Yeah.
Well, our concentration is the last 24.
Correct.
We have to know the last 24 hours of their life, who they were with, who saw them, what they were doing, where they were. Because that paints a picture for us of where we start primarily mm-hmm. with this investigation.
LaShawn, tell me about a case that sticks with you in particular that you helped on.
The slain and missing children from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. You mean the child murders?
Child murders. And the Chandra Levy case.
Uh-huh, the intern in
Washington, D.C. And the Mary Shotwell little case.
Why do those stick with you?
No matter how much time we devoted, no matter how much time we took, we kept thirsting for more, needed to know. The Chandra Levy case, her mother was so touching. We had to search. We had to give all we had. The remaining parents that were left of the slain and missing children and murdered children of Atlanta to listen to their stories will forever stay with me for the rest of my life. The Mary Shotwell little case was a case where she just totally vanished. She just disappeared. No one just disappears. And it will forever stay with me. Not saying that any other cases anything to me, but those three.
Did you guys find her? Did anyone find her? What had happened to her?
No, we didn't.
It's still unsolved?
It's still unsolved. To a degree, yeah.
So, Cheryl, from even many detectives who work with law enforcement talk about how traumatic it can be working on these cases, looking at crime scene photos, talking to victims' families. That's a very tough thing to mm-hmm. go through over and over. Why do you and the volunteers keep coming back when you're not paid?
Well, I think that's the reason. You just said it. That's the reason. Mm-hmm. It's not solved. It's not finished. They don't have answers. Mm-hmm. There has not been justice. So that's what fuels us right there. So when you talk to somebody like LaShawn, who started as a student, and now she's back at the Institute as an expert, there is nobody that I would entrust more in Atlanta if I needed PI work than LaShawn Bates, period. She's got it. She understands it. She does it. She's trained for it. So when these families come to us, they're not getting a group of students who are bored. They are getting national experts across the country like Holly Hughes and Kelly Ayers and Dwayne Thompson. They're getting the best there is out there mm-hmm. to help them on this case. And as well, they're getting, 2,000 fresh eyes to look at this thing to see what kind of solvability factors we can come up with. So, it's not difficult for us to stay excited about a case and to stay on fire about a case because we have each other. And, if somebody gets a little frustrated or gets a little down about something,
yes.
I'll bring somebody in like Dr. Vassatelli and, honey, you'll get fired back up pretty quick.
Yes.
Sorry, who's Dr. Vassatelli?
She's our criminal profiler.
I see. And you have experts in each different field. Blood spatter, I assume.
Oh, yeah. And I can call all kind of people. Detective Vince Velasquez has come on multiple occasions. And sometimes it's just to talk. Sometimes it's to tell them, look, when you get this degree and you get into your field, are you going to solve them all? No. But you've got to learn how to deal with that, too. And you've got to learn. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you've got to take that to get to the next case. And be prepared. You're not going to solve every one of them, but you're going to solve some of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, LaShawn, what we hear from law enforcement all the time is that the real investigations are nothing like what you see on television.
No.
No, you're saying no, that's not true, or no, they are not at all the same?
No, they're not all the same. We have some shows that's really, really close.
Like?
First 48 hours.
Okay.
But, it's a mind where you have to go where the facts lead you, whether you like it or not.
What do you mean, whether you like it or not?
Well, because sometimes you go in with a mindset of how you think things should be or how things happen or where you should direct yourself to go to. But once you start unraveling and you see where the direction takes you, you have no other choice but to go that direction. Whether you want to.
I can give
you
an example.
Okay, go ahead.
LaShawn and I, we with a small group of students, met with the ex-imperial wizard of the Klan.
Yes.
And I will never forget, LaShawn looks at me and she said, Mac, what do you mean ex-Klansman? And I said, well, he says he's no longer in the Klan. We'll see. I said, but he's got information we need.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't want to go. She didn't want to sit with this man. She didn't want to hear anything this guy had to say.
LaShawn is an African-American woman.
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Cheryl.
And she's like, Mac, you're out of your mind. I said, listen to me. I've never joined the Klan. I do not have the information that y'all need on the last mass lynching in the United States.
Correct.
He does. And I said, you don't always sit with people because you like them or necessarily even respect them. But if they can help on a case, then dadgummit, that's what we need to do.
Exactly.
Honey, by the time that meeting was over, she and the ex-Imperial Wizard were hugging. Everybody's crying. They're all buddies. So, again, I think LaShawn learned something in that moment that will carry her the rest of her life about human nature.
Right.
He joined the Klan basically because he didn't have another way out, not because he hated anybody. So it wasn't that different than a family member of LaShawn's that joins a street gang.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see another way out.
Correct.
So it was a powerful day for us.
I wonder, Cheryl, how do you choose the cases? If something's going to take a year or more, you must have to choose pretty carefully.
In the beginning, I chose cases that had a different area of study for the students. So, like with Sean Jalevi, it could be forensic anthropology. With Natalie Holloway, it was underwater crime scene. Mm-hmm. But now, after 10 years, families and law enforcement come to us. So we now take cases on because we're requested to.
And we've mentioned Sean Jalevi a number of times, just as a reminder for people listening, if you've forgotten, because that was all the way back in 2001, I believe. She was an intern in D.C. at the Federal Bureau of Prisons and was presumed murdered when her remains were discovered in a park. So, LaShawn, now this has become your life. You not only did this as a volunteer, you have now become a bail bondsman and a private investigator, correct?
That's correct.
What skills, you talked about how you suddenly discovered all these skills that you didn't know you had. What were they?
I want to say the ability to think outside the box. You know, sometimes you could be just tunnel vision. But I learned how to think outside the box. I learned how to live outside the box. Also, from the job I do now to cold case, you have to be accurate. You have to be precise. Timeline is everything. You understand?
Yeah, that does not actually all that far away from an investigative journalist.
No.
And you have to stay objective.
That's correct. And you have to stay objective. That's correct. So developing those skills within yourself allows your talents, meaning to look at something and be able to pick out information that maybe somebody else don't see. From where you will go into a apartment where somebody was killed and you can't figure out why the shoes are, you know, why they can't find the footprints, and you don't realize that, you know, did you check the closet? The shoes are missing. Maybe they went in with one pair of shoes and came out with another pair. Somebody may not think like that, but I do.
So, Cheryl, I wonder how your relationship is with law enforcement. I mean, certainly by rumor.
It's fabulous.
Okay, go ahead.
No,
because
fabulous.
It's not always you know, we don't always get this welcome mat from law enforcement saying, please, citizens and volunteers, help
right.
us solve cases.
Right.
Well, let me tell you, the majority of the experts, we are law enforcement. So it's not like we come in there as straight civilians. And the other issue is we don't Monday morning quarterback. So I'm not going to come on this show or any other show and tell you how some police department somewhere screwed something up. That's not the case, ever, hardly. You've got detectives that still, even in retirement, are trying to solve cases, and that's a fact. And this summer has showed me that over and over and over. Every single state that I have rolled in since July 1st, you have got somebody dedicated and devoted and thinks about that family constantly. So we speak to them cop to cop. Dwayne Thompson goes with me a lot. You know, Holly Hughes. I mean, I can't even name all the people that have helped. Larry Davis. I mean, just across the country, people that have helped. And so when we get to law enforcement, here's the deal. We were in Elmer City, Oklahoma recently. Really small town. They don't have a criminal profiler. We have 50. So we can put people on this thing
That maybe the resources that law enforcement doesn't have, which is
amazing.
Cheryl
McCall. And again, it's not going to cost them anything.
Yeah, and we'll have to cut you off there, but what an amazing conversation. Cheryl McCollum and LaShawn Bates of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, we talk with one of Atlanta's most famous crime novelists, and we'll go on a ride along with a Georgia State Trooper. This is On Second Thought.
You would not believe your eyes if 10 million fireflies lit up the world as I fell asleep. 'Cause they fill the open air and leave teardrops everywhere. You'd think me rude, but I would just stand and stare.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Macon native Mark Smith spent 9 years as a Marine. He completed 3 tours overseas, but it was his second tour in Iraq that cost him his left leg when he stepped on a mine in Ramadi. Despite that injury, Smith served another tour in Afghanistan. That's where he was, as he puts it, blown up again after his convoy hit an IED. Now Mark Smith is back home in Georgia with a new job in law enforcement. He is the first amputee to graduate from the state's trooper school. Producer Jessica Metzger recently rode along with Trooper Smith while on duty in Perry, Georgia, and she brings us this audio postcard.
75 southbound. Growing up, I always knew I wanted to be law enforcement or military, one of the two. And as I got older, it kind of progressed more towards military first. And so, hence, I did the military first right out of high school. I did a total of 9 years, and I was up for reenlistment again. And a buddy of mine, who's a trooper, we graduated high school together, and he went into law enforcement, I went into the military, and he was telling me about how the State Patrol was hiring, and I figured at that point, you know, 3 tours already, I've been blown up a few times, so it's time to, you know, take a new course. And then, yeah, I got one.
All this shows me is whether or not you're active and valid. I can't run it and see how many tickets you got in the past.
If you go on, let's see. I got injured October. When did I get injured? See, my birthday was October 8th, and I got October 13th, because it was 5 days after my 21st birthday. We were on a dismounted foot patrol, and we had to cross the street. And in crossing the street was where they had put the. I think it was a landmine or something, but because it was kind of in water, so I was sloshing through the water and just ended up stepping on it. I remember thinking to myself, because you see in the war movies, you know, the guys get hurt like that and they always end up passing out because of the pain. And I was praying to God. I was like, please let me pass out because this really hurts. Sometimes they get upset that you're giving them a ticket. Other times, like that lady, she was like, oh, sorry. And once I did get my leg, it was luckily because I'm a below the knee amputee, it wasn't nothing to it. I just put it on and started walking. And the biggest part of it was just conditioning my body to be able to wear my leg long enough. Because when you start out, it's pretty painful. You can't wear your leg and stand up on it and put pressure on your stump. But, you know, only so many, you start out with so many minutes a day and then so many hours a day and then just kind of work your way up. This is radar right here. I have a front antenna right here. So I can check like that car right there coming up. He's doing about 50 miles an hour. I do have different legs. I have like a swimming leg. I have a running leg. I guess you'd call the leg I'm wearing now is my work leg, just because it's designed to where I'm able to wear my backup pistol on my ankle. And I actually even have a peg leg. I mean, why not? So it's Halloween. I'm pretty much always a pirate. 1049, 108, one arrest. There's other occupations out there, but this is one of those that you definitely have to have the calling for it, because especially in law enforcement nowadays, with you know, how law enforcement is increasingly unpopular with people, and so you definitely have to have that calling to be able to deal with all the stuff that we encounter. Whereas like a 9-to-5 desk job, if you make a mistake, oh well, the reports don't get put in on time. Out here, if you make a mistake, it could, you know, literally be, you know, life or death. I'm not trying to, you know, church it up or anything, but that's just the truth of it. Barry, you have traffic 594.
Barry, 594, 91.
Georgia 96 and Hauser's Mill Road. They're just checking on me.
Our thanks to the Georgia State Patrol for letting us ride along with Trooper Mark Smith. This is a special hour on crime, and we include fictional crime in that category. So let's listen back to my interview with author Karen Slaughter. Slaughter's the author of many international bestsellers, and her book Pretty Girls was published last year. It's about two women whose teenage sister vanished without a trace. Karen Slaughter joined me back in May. She says there's some lightness in the story.
Well, you know, I'm the youngest of three girls, and most of my stories when I was a little girl were about my sisters disappearing or being murdered or getting in trouble, and then my parents loved me the best, which, you know, probably they did love me best anyway. So it was just sort of me writing that relationship. And in the book, Julia, the oldest sister, when she's 19 years old, she's a college student at UGA, and she just disappears. They have no idea what happened to her. And I wanted to explore what would happen to a family broken apart by a crime like that. So this was kind of my way to exorcise those demons.
Did your family, your sisters, or your parents read those stories you wrote about your sisters disappearing?
They did. And actually, I think today I'd probably be put on Ritalin or something, but... Actually, my teachers were very supportive, and they focused me into creative writing and really nurtured that weirdness in me. My best advice came from my ninth grade teacher, though, because she said, you can't kill everyone in your stories. You have to have some balance.
You are trying to kill all the people.
Exactly.
You were a young George R. R. Martin.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. My whole Red Wedding was like my whole oeuvre before I hit the ninth grade. But, you know, I do think that was an important lesson for me. You do have to balance some of that darkness with lightness. And in Pretty Girls, I use that relationship between the two remaining sisters and the family. And, you know, I love reading thrillers. It's my passion. And I'm never interested in that unrelenting darkness. So I always think about one of my favorite short stories by a good Georgia native, Flannery O'Connor, where she's talking about a serial killer named the Misfit, and a good man is hard to find.
Good man is hard to find.
And I love that line where the serial killer says about the grandmother that she would have been a good woman if someone had killed her every single day of her life. You know, and that's the kind of, I think, Southern humor and lightness that balances out some of that more dark material.
Why do you like reading thrillers? You know, oftentimes I'll talk to authors who write a certain genre of book, but that's not what they read in their off time.
Gosh, you know, I've heard people do that, and I understand it on some level because I'm lucky that a lot of thriller writers are my friends, and I don't want to read their book and think, oh, you know, I hate this, or I know Lee Child, and so sometimes
wrote a great blurb for your
book.
Yeah,
he did, yeah. But sometimes I'll hear his voice instead of my voice for Jack Reacher, and I can understand that, but I mean... The thing that made me want to write thrillers and work on the puzzle of writing a mystery novel, I mean, the main thing that really put me on that road was reading Encyclopedia Brown or Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys, or, you know, I did take a detour into V.C. Andrews and all that as a teenager.
Flowers like, in the Attic.
Exactly,
yeah.
Or Lace.
Yes.
But, you know, once I got past all that drivel, I was back into reading thrillers. Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton, you know, so these were the types of books that made me want to really be a writer.
What does it take to be a really good thriller writer? I mean, when you're reading somebody else's work, what books do you, what do you read that makes you throw the book down in disgust? And what do you read where you say, wow, this is good?
Well, you know, primarily, I'll start with the language in some of these. A friend of mine, Denise Mina, she's a Scottish crime writer. She's amazing. And the language in her books is so impeccable. I remember the last line I read of hers that just made me green with envy. She's talking about a character's watching the waves and describes the cresting waves like when you slice the top of a bag of sugar. And I mean, that was just so beautiful. And I hated her so much at that point, you know, it actually took me out of the book because I was like, I can't believe how great this is. So that's what excites me. What I hate is what everybody who reads thrillers hates is when it doesn't make sense, you know, or you think, you know, you're 10 pages away and you think, gosh, the writer just figured this out. And suddenly there's like a pubic hair that's found and they pick it up and put it under a microscope and someone says he was a left-handed killer. He hated his mother, you know, and I hate that. I really... The only person I think that I can think of off the top of my head that can really do forensics well is Jeff Deaver. And that's because generally it's not the big solve is through a microscope, you know. So I like when the puzzle is there and they play fair with me and I can figure it out along the way. And when I get to the end, it's like, aha, instead of what the heck.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Karen Slaughter. She's an Atlanta native and an author of a number of bestsellers. Her latest is called Pretty Girls, and it's now out in paperback. I wonder if it ever gave you pause, because you're such a strong writer and the writing has such integrity just as writing, and you worried you would not get the respect that, say, if you were writing adult fiction, right, that people think about. The reason I ask this is because I think about Stephen King, who's a brilliant, just a writer. And if you were writing anything other than horror, he might be taken differently in a scholarly sense. Did you ever give that any thought?
The genre doesn't matter so much to me. I mean, I didn't go into the genre thinking, oh my God, people aren't going to take me seriously. I kind of knew that as a thriller reader and as someone who studied Renaissance poetry in college, but still people couldn't believe if I had a Stephen King paperback, you know, so something must be wrong with me. I'm not a serious literature person. But, you know, honestly, I mean, he's a perfect example. His characters are amazing. I would hold up Dolores Claiborne to any character, Faulkner, Hemingway, any of those guys. I mean, just an amazing character. And not least of all, because it's somebody who's actually interested in writing about a well-developed woman. But for me, you know, I'm not really concerned so much with the genre. I do wish that thrillers were taken seriously, but we sell a heck of a lot. So it's kind of weird to complain that we're the best-selling genre, you know. And for me, I just think it's important to tell a story. And I would defy you to mention any book that has endured in the American canon that doesn't have some sort of crime or murder. I mean, Gone with the Wind, there is an extremely brutal and violent murder. You know, when we watch it in the South on at the Fox, everybody hisses when the Yankee comes up into Tara, and there's Scarlett there, and she has her gun, and he's going through her mom's sewing box, and she shoots him in the face. And in the book, the way she describes the hole in his face, the blood trickling across the floor, and she actually says Scarlett wants to dance. She's barefoot. She wants to dance in his still warm blood. I mean, that's a thriller passage. So if that's a thriller, then I think I'm in good company.
But tell me a little bit about getting into the minds. I find it fascinating that people often ask crime writers, male crime writers, wow, you wrote a great female character. How did you get into the mind of the female? But they never ask females, wow, you wrote a great male character. How did you get into the mind of the male? But I find myself sometimes thinking, and not necessarily in this book, but in some of your other books, if there is anything that you do differently when you're writing a male character, because you do write them so well and so authentically.
Well, thank you. You know, I'll make a very blanket statement, because obviously this doesn't apply to men and women universally. But when I'm writing Will Trent, for instance, he's much more of a let's not talk about the problem, let's solve the problem, or pretend it's not even there. I think a lot of men have that in them, you know.
Problem solvers.
Right. They want to solve that problem. And what's the point of talking about it endlessly? And a lot of women feel like they need to talk it out. And I'm kind of a mixture of those two things, depending on the problem. That's why I'm saying it's a blanket statement. And I think Will is too. You know, sometimes he wants to talk it out more, and usually he's talking to Faith, his partner. And I think at work, it's easier for him to talk things out with Faith than it is at home to talk things out with Sarah. Because with Sarah, he's more like, you know, kind of afraid to talk about how he feels about something, because that might be a weakness and she might not be attracted to him anymore. And, you know, all that gets caught up in there. So yeah, I just those are the things I keep in mind. And I wrote a character, Jeffrey Tolliver, in my earlier books.
The sheriff.
And he was more of a touchy-feely kind of guy. But then I had him do things like beat up suspects and get in car accidents and shoot people, and to kind of balance it out to make him manly. So Will was a response to that, thinking, well, let me do a different kind of guy character, because there are a lot of different guys out there.
There's also, I mean, when we're speaking about authenticity, there's also clearly a great deal of authenticity in the places of your books. These are areas that you know very, very well, not just for Will Trent, but Grant County, and then some of those that take place. This book, Pretty Girls, well, it kind of, they drive a lot of different places. They kind of span a certain area of the state. And I wonder, have you ever wanted to write about another location, or is there something about really, really knowing a place intimately that helps you as a writer?
Well, yeah, I think it does help to know. You know, if you look at Bradbury, when he's writing about Mars.
Ray Bradbury, science fiction
writer. Ray Bradbury. He's really writing about his hometown, right? And I think that we...
And Stephen King writing about Maine.
Exactly, yeah. So I really, when I started out, I made a conscious choice to write about Atlanta. And so this was, well, when I wrote this book 18 years ago, so I was 12, basically. But it was a really kind of radical choice not to set it in Los Angeles or New York or some crimey place like that at the time. Nobody was really writing about Atlanta in a realistic criminal kind of way. So it was a choice on my part. And instead of writing about a big town, I wanted to write about a small town because that's what I grew up in. I grew up in Jonesboro, Georgia, which is a lot like Grant County. You know, we had the junior college. That was our big claim to fame. And so I wanted to really kind of write what I know. But I think you should also write what you want to know. And I wanted to know more about crime. And, of course, I was in Jonesboro when the Atlanta child murders were going on. And so I remember very distinctively, you know, that time before the murders, before children were being targeted, before it was on the news all the time, before people were terrified. And then after, I wasn't allowed to go outside without my parents knowing where I was. And, you know, before that, literally, we would be locked out of the house in the summer because my mother couldn't stand us underfoot. And she's like, go outside and play. And if you get thirsty, there's the hose. And if you have to go to the bathroom, there's the woods. After that, I mean, our lives totally changed. It was just a really transformative time because of this crime occurring. And we know how far Jonesboro is from Atlanta, you know, especially then. I mean, 45 minutes was an eternity. Jonesboro was considered a very small town. But it did terrify us, and it changed how our community was. And so that's what I really wanted to write about.
That's Georgia native and crime writer Karen Slaughter. She's the author of many international bestsellers. And her book, Pretty Girls, is about two women whose teenage sisters vanished without a trace. That's our show for today, but you know we need your book recommendations, right? I know you guys read a lot, so tell us, which author of thrillers do you love? Call 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. I am at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.